From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. We're going to finish out the week strong. This hour, we're going to be joined by Molly Fletcher, renowned sports super agent, world's top 50 most motivational speakers, and author of a brand new book, Dynamic Drive, The Purpose-Fueled Formula for Sustainable Success. So we'll talk to her. Waiting in the wings is Admiral James Stavridis. He's got another book rolling out shortly. It's going to be coming out in October, The Restless Wave. We'll get to that. But we also need his expertise on the many challenges overseas, including Zelensky. We have President Zelensky coming here next week to lobby the world, the free world, and President Biden in particular on his plan to win. And that is to take the restrictions off the weapons we gave them. In many cases, they paid for. Seems to be a no-brainer, but not with this administration. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The GBI has arrested Colin Gray in connection to the shooting here at Appalachia High School. Colin is Colt Gray's father. He is charged with the following: four counts of involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah, he's going to be in... he's going to be in court in a matter of moments. The father, second-degree manslaughter for buying the gun for his son, who, by all accounts, let everybody know he's potentially a school shooter, and who was pretty much red-flagged about a year ago as somebody that could be dangerous. That is the Georgia shooting. Not only is the shooter in custody already, he's confessed to it, but his father's in jail and charged with second-degree manslaughter. Why this is a much bigger story than just a tragic Georgia school shooting. Plus, the AP tars J.D. Vance.
Number two.
Again, I think it's important to call out those foreign actors, but to simply isolate it as this one specific issue when we know that every other country out there is probably trying to interfere. I think it's important to be very aware, not just of Russia.
Yeah, it would help. We know this. That was Linnea Moynihan of the New York Post. Election meddling. Justice Department looks at Russian influencers and Russian TV. Okay, fine. I think we have to broaden the scope. The Trump campaign has already been cyber attacked by Iran, and China has never stopped.
Number one.
In those roles, I took on perpetrators of all kinds.
Predators who abused women. Fraudsters who ripped off consumers. Cheaters who broke the rules for their own gain.
Really? Who is the crime fighter Kamala Harris? What does her background say about her, about what she believes in, and what has she done in the past? We have the elusive backstory and track record as we piece together both the Trump and Harris economic plans that they think will propel them to victory, days away from the one and possibly only debate. With us right now, Admiral James Stavridis, the 16th Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, and his book is going to be coming out shortly, The Restless Wave. Admiral, welcome back.
Always great to be with you, Brian.
Okay, let's fast forward to the Middle East. Yesterday, I had a chance to talk to the Prime Minister, Netanyahu, and I asked him. It says the Jerusalem Post is reporting that a peace deal is 90% done, and he said nothing could be further from the truth. What do you think should be the next step with in Gaza?
I think that the Israelis are going to continue to hold on to what's called the Philadelphia Corridor, which is the strip of border in between southern Gaza and Egypt. And, Brian, I think they should hold on to that. It really is the mechanism by which Gaza could be resupplied by Iran. So I think the Israelis are going to be hard on that position, and therefore I think the chances of a deal, frankly, are unlikely.
So now we find out there was a report that Sinwar's goal was to get through those corridors, get through those tunnels, and get into Iran with hostages. I mean, you'd never get them again. And if people aren't keeping score with this conflict, Sinwar is the bin Laden of this operation. But now that's been shut down. Admiral, to what degree do you think the Israelis are surprised about the sophistication of these tunnels and about how many there were in this corridor?
Brian, I have a piece out in Bloomberg about tunnel warfare, and we're all kind of acting like, hey, this is a brand new thing. It's really scary. Actually, tunnels have been around in warfare going back to the ancient Greeks. And to answer your question, however, I think the Israelis were unpleasantly surprised at how big this complex is. I think they would have thought it would have been dozens of miles instead of hundreds of miles of tunnels. This is really where the opponents, where Hamas, abetted by Iran, have been able to train, equip, organize, and launch these attacks. So I think that the tunnels are actually the center of gravity in this military operation. And therefore, I think you're going to see the Israelis not only hold on to the Philadelphia corridor, but I think they are methodically going to go through and destroy these tunnels. And that's what they should do. All of that, of course, is terrible news for the hostages and the hostage families. And so the Israelis ought to continue to negotiate where they can, but destroy where they must. And they must destroy this tunnel complex.
What do you think the protests in Colombia, the protests around the country, you see the pressure being put on Netanyahu by our government? What do you think that does for Hamas?
I think it supports Hamas, and many of these protests are shamefully have chanted support for this horrific terrorist organization that just in the last few days put bullets in the back of the heads of young hostages about the age of some of these protesters. I would say for the protesters, wake up and see the truly evil nature of Hamas. Support for them is unconscionable, and we ought to be supporting Israel strongly through this period, and that requires us to stay firm against Iran. You and I have talked about this, Brian. At the end of the day, what's happening in Gaza is a tactical operation. It's important that the Israelis win, but the really big game, the great game in the Middle East is the role Iran is playing. That's where we need to direct more of our attention.
So if I could fast forward to Ukraine, we know Zelensky is going to be coming to town next week to address the General Assembly, and he's also going to meet with President Biden. He's going to pitch his case as he shakes up his cabinet to remove the restrictions from the weapon system we gave them. Let me put you in the room. How do you think that'll go?
I think ultimately the Biden administration, which has been unfortunately late to need in supporting the Ukrainians with armaments. Every time the Ukrainians have asked for something, it's taken months, or even in the case of the F-16 aircraft, years before we got it in the hands of the Ukrainians. Now we have finally put basically the full suite of weapons in the hands of the Ukrainians. Now the problem is that we are restricting Ukraine's use of these weapons to their own territory. It's time to really allow the Ukrainians to strike, frankly, wherever they want inside Russia. I don't think they'll go to Moscow. I know they won't go after civilian population centers the way that Vladimir Putin does, because that's a war crime, and the Ukrainians will not commit war crimes. But we ought to tell the Ukrainians, if you want to strike military targets inside Russia, 300 miles, 400 miles, go after those fuel depots, go after those ammunition caches, go after the industrial capacity to make war. That's only fair. And I think that's the case he'll pitch. I am hopeful the administration will take the gloves off the Ukrainians.
So it's great that they have 500 square miles in Kursk, right? I got that. But it looks like the Russians have not taken and redirected forces to stop the advancement. That's what Zelensky says he was hoping for. Was he wrong to hope for that? Or do you think that Russia's in denial because they know Zelensky wants that?
I think the latter. I think that Zelensky and his generals correctly assess that they could create this, this, if you will, military salient, this chunk of territory, this perimeter, this peninsula into Russia. I think they ought to hold on to it. They were hoping to see a big diversion of forces. That hasn't happened. But I think the value for the Ukrainians remains it's a bargaining chip. They've taken many Russian prisoners. And above all, they've shown the world and their allies, and this will help Zelensky when he comes to pitch his case, that they are capable of multi-domain operations, which is just a fancy military term for bringing together tanks, artillery, armored personnel carriers, cybersecurity, logistics, infantry, special forces, bringing it all together in a way that we haven't seen Russia do effectively. So I think on balance, it's turned out well. Often in war, you don't achieve all your objectives. But I think if the Ukrainians had it to do again, they'd launch the same attack.
I want you to hear what General Jack Keane told me half hour ago, cut 44.
What Zelensky has already demonstrated to us, that he clearly intends to put more pressure on Russia, and certainly taking 500 square miles of territory in the Kursk Oblast, better known as a province, is an indicator of the seriousness of that intent. Also, he wants to be able to fire long-range weapons into the very military bases that are attacking him from Russia, into the air bases that are delivering these horrific attacks we've seen in the last 2 weeks. I mean, it's absolutely appalling that we're restricting him from doing something like that. Normally in warfare, the invading country attacks you, certainly have the right to go back and attack that invading country.
Now, I agree with you. I agree with General Keane. I think I'm in good company, but I'm not alone. But I'm not, I don't know if I'm the majority. A lot of our people in our country are saying, you know, we're provoking Putin into a nuclear war. Never before has a nuclear nation been invaded since nuclear weapons became regular for this world in the 1950s. And we're supporting a country doing that. What do you say to people who are worried about Zelensky having the restrictions lifted?
I share their worry, and I would point to the fact that again and again, Vladimir Putin has said, here's my red line. I'm a nuclear power, and here's my red line. His first one was, oh, what if Sweden and Finland were to join NATO? Well, that was a red line. Nothing happened. What if we gave the Ukrainians M1, A1, Abrams battle tanks? That was a red line. Nothing happened. Now they have F-16s. That was a red line for Putin. So again and again, Putin has shown he's a paper tiger on this, and here's why. He knows if he were to use tactical nuclear weapons to respond against Ukraine, it would cause the entire world to turn against Russia. That's simply the nature of the global political moment. And then if people say to me, hey, Putin could launch an all-out nuclear war with the United States, my response is no way. You know, I despise Vladimir Putin. I'm sanctioned personally by Russia. But I will give him this. He loves his country. He loves Russia. He is not going to reach for the lever to the nuclear apocalypse and destroy the world, to include Russia. So he won't go big nuke. And I think the chances of him going small nuke are very, very low for the reason I mentioned. Global public opinion will deter him.
I want you to hear what Marco Rubio, as foreign policy, the analogy is always, I think, really strong. And I think he does it again. Cut 46.
My biggest problem with the Biden approach to Ukraine is they've never defined what is victory, what is the strategy, what is the outcome that we're trying to help them achieve or get to. Because if you don't have a strategy, you don't have a defined outcome, then what are you funding? What are you funding if you don't have a strategy? How do you even know that what you're funding is the right amount or the right things? And I think that's what's imperiled U.S. support to Ukraine in terms of Congress.
So is he right?
What I would say is here's the objective. Ultimately, we want to punch Vladimir Putin in the nose hard, show him that this attack on Ukraine has been stopped. That does not mean we're going to be able, my view, to push every Russian out of occupied Ukraine. But by stopping him, by the loss to him of at least 100,000, maybe 150,000 Russians killed in action, 300,000 wounded, 600,000 have left the country of Russia to avoid the draft, punch him in the nose hard, then take that 80% of Ukraine that remains, bring them into NATO, bring them into the European Union. And that's failure for Putin. It's success for Ukraine. And final thought, Brian, it's success for NATO. When this thing is over, wherever that final battle line is drawn, when this thing is over, the Ukrainians are going to have the most highly blooded, technically capable, and experienced ground forces in Europe. Believe me, we want them inside NATO. I think that's how this comes out.
I also think we need a weapon system, a defensive weapon system right on their border, to whatever that border ends up being, to make to stop the next snap invasion.
Absolutely. And we could talk in depth about how you establish that in the future, maybe next week. But I think that is going to be crucial as well, Brian.
All right, Adam, we're looking forward to your next book. Comes out in just over a month, right? No, just under a month.
It's called The Restless Wave, and it's set in the early days of World War II. It's historical fiction. But look at what's happening. It's great power war between the U.S. and Japan. It's new technologies emerging. It's surprise attacks. It's all the things we're facing today. It's a way to talk about them, but to set it in a very fascinating historical context, The Restless Wave.
Fantastic. Admiral James Tervidas, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Pre-order it now. All right. When we come back, we'll take some calls. Bottom of the hour, we motivate you with one of the most successful sports agents in the country. Don't move. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
GBI has arrested Colin Gray, age 54, in connection to the shooting here at Appalachia High School. Colin is Colt Gray's father that was arrested yesterday. He is charged with the following: 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter, 2 counts of second-degree murder, and 8 counts of cruelty to children. Mr. Gray, these charges stem from Mr. Gray knowingly allowing his son, Colt, to possess a weapon.
So that just happened moments ago. The Georgia High School school shooter, 13 years old. He's 14 years old, rather. He was charged with 4 counts of murder. That was his father, Colt Gray's father, who was count of a second-degree manslaughter. And I tell you, it's hard to push back against it. He knew there was a problem. He was confronted last year about the problem, at the end of last year about the problem. He got his son a gun anyway. The kid at that age can't get ammo, got ammo, taught him how to shoot. Obviously, the family, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but the background of the family, his wife or former wife was addicted to meth, in and out of jails, got a huge rap sheet. He looks like the worst father possible. Evidently, there's scenes from the neighborhood. These kids were, and his sister were, a mess, unshowered, unclean, always complaining, reaching out. They were totally failed by their parents. And now there's 2 kids dead and 2 teachers dead, 9 wounded because of their irresponsibility. And that's what you got to do. I know there's situations where the parents are helpless. Kids are mentally bored, mentally ill, and got some challenges. Doesn't seem to be this case and been the case in Michigan. And it doesn't seem to be this case over in Georgia. All right, when we come back, we'll change the speeds. Molly Fletcher will be with us. She's a dynamic speaker, super sports agent, has a brand new book out, and we'll talk about the dynamic drive, the purpose-fueled formula for sustainable success. Don't move.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Brian Kilmeade Show in a little while. We'll keep you up to date on what's happening or breaking in the news now, but we'll take somewhat of a break and talk to Molly Fletcher, a renowned sports agent and world top 50 motivational speaker. She's got a brand new book out called Dynamic Drive, The Purpose-Fueled Formula for Sustainable Success. Molly, welcome.
It's good to be with you.
So tell everyone what got you. You were a walk-on college tennis player,
right?
And you hurt your knee, but you're still competing, high-level athlete.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I could say that the knee is the reason I didn't go play professional tennis, but the truth is, man, I wasn't even close to that level, to be honest. But yeah, I was a walk-on at Michigan State. Loved the business of sports, truly. sort of all my life. And then I wanted to get into the business of sports. So I moved to Atlanta because the Super Bowl was coming. The Olympics was coming. Moved to Atlanta to get into the sports business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was an unbelievable journey, almost two decades as a sports agent.
How'd you break in?
You know, my first job, I answered the phones at Super Bowl 28. And then through that, my whole philosophy was, how do I get people to like and respect me enough to hire me or help me? And essentially, after about 6 months or 12 months, I got an opportunity with a small agency. And I was in charge of driving Lenny Wilkins around through the Olympics. And then after that finished, I remember—
Men's team coach.
Men's team coach
of
the Dream
Team. Very good player too, right?
Totally. Oh, unbelievable. And Hall of Fame coach. But after I finished, I thought, man, like, how are we going to grow? We had a couple NBA coaches, a couple baseball players. And so I literally went in and said, you know, what's our growth plan? How can we get more guys and more athletes, mostly men at the time? And so I started by going down to Georgia Tech because I wasn't going to go start out of the gates with, you know, A-Rod and Jeter, right? So I'm down at Georgia Tech trying to pick off top-round projected baseball guys. That progressed, and then one of our guys, John Smoltz, said, hey, Molly, you know, do you have any interest in golf? He had a golfer buddy that was needed an agent who was top 25 in the world.
Now, John Smoltz at that time was pitching for the Braves.
Right-handed pitcher for the Braves. Yep, yep. He was a starter for the Braves at the time.
Now he's an outstanding Fox Sports broadcaster.
Unbelievable. Yeah, he's great on the air. So, you know, it was about 300 athletes and coaches later, and then I started writing books about what I saw to be the common thread between peak performers, the way they think, the way they behave. And then I started getting asked to speak. And so now I speak about 100 days a year and write books, have a podcast. I'm trying to be like you, man.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a goal like everybody. So you have baseball, you understand basketball, you obviously grew up in tennis, and then you know a variety of sports and golf.
Sure.
So what was it like? You know, what kind of golfers did you represent?
So, you know, Matt Kuchar, Franklin Langham, when he played, I had about nine guys. I mean, it's an interesting space because traditionally you're with those guys or gals. But when you're standing on the range on a Tuesday with your players, kind of helping them as they prepare for a week, I mean, you can't be running back behind like seven golf bags, right? They're a little territorial. So I had about eight or nine at the peak, maybe.
Right.
Which was super fun. I mean, they're people that wake up every day like you, and they've got to perform. They've got to deliver. I mean, they're generally only as good as their last putt unless you've won a tournament or a major.
Right. So as you start covering them, then when did you realize they had something in common, despite the difference in sports?
Yeah, that's so, you know, Doc Rivers, Ernie Johnson, you know, Smoltz, a bunch of my other baseball guys. And I started to go, wow, these guys, they recover from adversity the same way. They deal with obstacles in a similar way. They embrace them, in fact. They love and embrace change. They welcome feedback. They're insatiably curious people. They're the kind of people that are eager to get better every day. And so what I started to see is this, every day they wake up and want to get a little bit better. And the truth is, it's because if they don't, they literally lose their jobs because there's people right behind them dying to take their spot. So when I started to see that, I thought, this is really cool. And that's what Dynamic Drive, my book that released this week, is all about, is how when we anchor what we pursue in life to be anchored against our purpose, it aligns with our actions and in turn our outcomes. Because I think what I saw as an agent is, Brian, what so many people don't see. Mm-hmm. You know, the world sees the trophies and the accolades and the big contracts and all the big moments of achievement. But I saw the relentless effort every day, the laser focus. What do they do after they win?
Mm-hmm.
What do they do after they lose? And the way they step into that, and that's what really is the culmination of this book, which is threaded with purpose and anchored with seven keys to unlock the best version of ourselves.
And so when you have somebody that is not achieving but has the drive and the drive, do you think the reason maybe you get to the bottom of it is they don't have a a misdiagnosis of success, what success looks like?
100%. I mean, what I worry about truly right now more than ever is that the world sees all these moments of achievement. There's so many superficial sort of likes that are happening in the world. And the truth is that won't fill you up. I always say that achievement doesn't bring fulfillment. Purpose does. And so to me, it's incredibly important to recognize, what are you chasing? You know, a lot of times with companies that I work with and speak is, what are you really chasing? What What are you in pursuit of?
So do you, is it money? Is one purpose could be money in order?
I mean, dynamic drive is about, this is an inside out pursuit. If you're chasing something external to fill you up, it you're going to be sorely disappointed. It's like, if you want to feel good for an hour, right, you can achieve, or for a couple days. But at the end of that, it's who are you becoming in that pursuit? And that's what I think is important for people to recognize, is who are you becoming in the pursuit of the daily rituals that you're embracing relative to getting better every day? Because the truth is, achievement is fleeting. And I believe that complacency, ironically, which is the opposite of dynamic drive, is highly sort of ripe to set in actually after you achieve. And part of what I saw with coaches is, like, I had a coach once win the national championship, Brian. The next morning at 8:30, he was on the phone with a kid begging him to come play basketball for him.
Right.
And that's the mindset of people with dynamic drive. The traditional definition of drive is about achievement, the sole pursuit of unachievement. I believe we need a new definition at some level, which is ever-changing inside of us and anchored in something bigger than the outcome itself.
So how do you divide that from obsession?
Well, I mean, relative to obsession, to me, is and ambition and passion, those are fantastic things. I think what dynamic drive is about is, are you intentionally obsessed? In other words, sometimes I think we're obsessed, or
an addiction. An obsession could be an addiction.
Yeah.
Not healthy by definition.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, if you're obsessed, and look, the truth is, I think balance is kind of BS, right? It doesn't work. I think it's about alignment. So I'm down for obsession as long as you know what you're compromising inside of it.
What do you mean you don't think balance works?
Well, balance is, I truly believe, I've been married for 25 years. I have three daughters. And to me, the pursuit of balance, whether you're a man or a woman, is completely unattainable. It's about saying, what are the things in my life that matter most, mm-hmm. personally, professionally? How do I want to show up in those sort of roles in my life? And then saying, how can I be intentional about what I say yes and no to? My husband and I had three kids in 12 months. We had one, and then we had twins. And I was trying to balance it all. And what was happening was, I was getting totally exhausted and fatigued. And we live in a world, like, are you kidding me, that we're going to wake up, go through our days with the amount of demand coming at leaders and people today, and then at the end of the day, the teeter-totter of everything physically, mentally, personally, professionally is perfectly balanced? No. I mean, to be the best, to do
sacrifice.
What you do. Yeah, so you have to pull back and say, what worries me is, I think sometimes people are compromising things in their life that matter most to them without intention.
So sports for you is not just about that Scottie Scheffler winning a PGA major. It is what everybody else is doing. Sports gives you an instant verdict relatively quickly, but everyone in life is waiting for that, is working towards that trophy in some respect.
I believe so, and I think we need to shift the lens to be, how can I ensure that the decisions I'm making, the actions I'm making, are aligned with who I want to become in that pursuit?
Mm-hmm.
Because if the sole focus is on outcome, I mean, when you right. think about it, if all you're focused on is winning the U.S. Open.
Right. And then you do it.
And then you do it.
Then
what do you do next?
It's
what
the
do
biggest
you do the next
letdown.
Day?
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is, if we're in the pursuit of better every day, after we win, we keep going.
Right.
We know what we're pursuing, which is truly a never-ending journey to become the best version of ourselves.
So one of the hottest players in sports is Caitlin Clark.
Yeah.
And she comes in WNBA, and immediately everyone knows who the Indiana Fever are. Everyone's going to Liberty games in New York, even though they've been around for 20 years.
Right.
And there's some legitimate resentment from the other players, even though she's proven that she is already an elite player. Is my assessment correct?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think. Look, I'm not inside of it. I certainly don't represent Caitlin Clark. I don't know her. But I think she, at some level, is a perfect example of dynamic drive, in that she, I believe, in her heart of hearts, thought, you know what? I don't know that I can get better at Iowa right now. Like, and again, I don't know her, but I think she thought, I'm just on a journey to become the best basketball player I can become. And this, I think, is the place that I can continue to get better and get pushed and get challenged. I think, look, I mean, she's this new, young, girl that's shown up in the league, and she's getting a whole lot of attention. And there's a bunch of vets that are like, hey,
and beating her
we've been doing this, girl. We've been doing this under the basket for a long time.
Here's what Charles Barkley said.
These ladies, and I'm a WNBA fan, they cannot have this Caitlin Clark thing up any worse if they tried. People believe what we say on television. Just because people don't like you or your personality, they can't get on TV and slander you. It's just total bullshit. This girl is incredible. The number of attention, eyeballs, she's brought to college and the pros, and for these women to have this petty jealousness, you say to yourself, damn, what is going on here? And the thing I love about her, she never says a word. But these ladies who I love and respect their game, they couldn't have f***ed this thing up any worse.
Your feeling on his thoughts?
I mean, well, first of all, Charles, you know, he's in Atlanta quite a bit. I'm based in Atlanta. I see him a lot. He's an absolute blast. I think that is part of the problem. Like, at some level, it's not about each individual player. It's about how can we make the game of basketball better together? And so I think, yes, in an altruistic world, I wish that they would put their arms around her and welcome her and know that, look, this is about women's basketball that has now become epic and on the scene in a wonderful way. So that's a great thing, and she's helped do that.
How do you feel about what's happening in college, major college sports, where we're watching these players go up to Nick Saban and say, hey, coach, we lost the championship. If you can't get me another $1 million, I'm going to go to Auburn, or I'm going to go to.
They're not going to Auburn from Alabama. My girls will go to Auburn. I hate to say that. But and Saban's, you know, Saban's on the beach now. But, yeah, I mean, it has changed tremendously. NIL, obviously what it's done to sports is it's a minor league system. And, you know, what I worry about is that when you – hand an 18-year-old kid $1 million and they're, you know, a D1 quarterback, that's fantastic, but that's $1 million and you're 18 years old. And by the way, the government's going to take a good bit of it. So what happens next? And so that's in part what I worry about. And this book is about is like, look, once you get your $1 million as a D1 quarterback, or you get whatever it is every year as they go, you haven't made it. Like, keep going.
But you're also going to get an agent in high school and college now, right? Maybe even in high school.
Oh, I mean, NIL's changed the game fully. I mean, now you've got agents. I mean, I think, you know, these guys can get paid, you know, in their teens in
high school.
They'll
stay 4 years now.
Potentially, right? Yeah. I mean, if they can keep the deals landed and now with, you know, you can get the policies to protect your body and all that. I mean, it is – college sports is not college sports. It's a minor league system.
To go
to the next level, potentially.
Does anyone go to class?
It's a heck of a time to be a college athlete. I mean, dang, man. But, right. I mean, where was the money for women's tennis, Brian? I mean, you know what I'm saying? No,
well,
I'm kidding.
Well, that's true, because as a soccer player, it's a non-revenue sport.
100%.
And you can put up the great product. But if you're not putting people in the stands, what happens is football and basketball pay for those
100%.
In many cases.
Yes.
So, and they're willing to do it. And if you talk to Lou Holtz, the old school guys, they say, yeah, we fund the whole athletic department. Well, it's not really fair to those players is the pushback. And now the courts are involved. The NCAA has been pushed aside.
Totally.
So I think the whole game has changed. And you as an agent, if you decide to get back into it, you can make a lot of money off a 19-year-old running back from University of Texas.
Absolutely. No, you can. And I believe, what I always used to say is 90% of my job was managing their life, their career, their tomorrows.
Right.
Not just negotiating their contract. Sure, you make money on the contract, but the truth is, in my the good agents that are doing things the right way, they're not worried about the one and done, the 1 year.
Yeah.
They're trying to make sure they navigate that guy's career or that gal's career into the next level in a perfect world.
How do we get Dynamic Drive?
Yeah, absolutely. It's anywhere books are sold. Again, it's Molly Fletcher, Dynamic Drive. And so anywhere books are sold, Amazon. And, of course, you can go to also getdynamicdrive.com.
All right. And, of course, book you as a speaker. How do you do that?
MollyFletcher.com.
There you go.
I love it.
All right. Molly, thanks so much. Congratulations on the book and all your success. Brian Kilmeade Show, back in a moment.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You have to stand and answer for all the damage that you've done. That's a real problem for Kamala Harris, and especially When you talk about the economy, people are upset. Two-thirds or three-quarters of the country think that we're going in the wrong direction. They want to get back to that Trump economy. And so Kamala Harris has really two challenges. Has to defend her record, but then you can't go and say, I'm going to turn the page when you created the nightmare that we're living in.
Right. I mean, this is the whole dynamic that Trump has got to really make huge gains because she's not speaking to the press regularly. I'm not even talking about easy interviews with Rachel Maddow. I'm talking about, you know, going to CNN. It'll probably be, if you go on CNN and just ask, or ABC or NBC, you're going to get some real questions, and that will create a dynamic. Like, for example, you know, Bidenomics for the last 3.5 years been saying how great it was. Now you feel as though it's not great. Were you lying then or are you lying now? What are you going to do different? Are you just trying to separate yourself from a president that's got 41% approval rating for the last 3.5 years that dropped down to 36 when they thought he was running? So what are you supposed to say? And then her answer will gauge about what you believe that she's going to do. So, for example, you have Kathy Hochul coming out saying, I am against fracking. We're not going back. All right. This woman, Senator Kamala Harris, felt the same way. Candidate Kamala Harris felt the same way. Against fracking. Now, all of a sudden, she'll come for fracking. Well, Joe Biden was for fracking. You said, well, you're going to, Joe Biden's for it. Now, are you really believe what Governor Kathy Hochul says, which is, I'm not going back? Because that is your phrase, and now you're saying you're going to do it. So we just don't have any definition of how she's going to handle things. Howard, listening in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Howard, over in Coyle.
Brian, two things that Trump must do at Tuesday's debate.
Yep.
Number one, use facts to make the case. Empty phrases, bets like me so much, all that, will not stick. They won't get him hired by the independent voters. Number two, January 6th. Take on this threat to democracy concern that Americans have. In the first debate, he dodged the question. It kind of makes him look guilty. He lamely pointed a finger at Pelosi. What did Trump hope to achieve? Tell us. Admission that he could have handled things better might blow the lid off this feeling on his approval level.
I hear you, but he actually wants to give out January 6th awards. That's him overcompensating. But I agree with you, Howard. Get some facts out there. Not greatest economy ever. Tell me what made it great and what you'll do to keep it that way.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everybody. I'm talking Charlie Hurd, Brian Kilmeade Show. We are back and ready to go. Finishing out the week strong, and it's been a very impactful week. We know what happens next week on September 10th. We're all going to be watching on ABC because Donald Trump will have the one and only debate with Kamala Harris. And we have Trump saying, hey, remember what I did? And Kamala Harris says, I know what Joe did. I know what I used to think, but I'm not really going to tell you what I'm going to do, but I'm going to tell you what spices I like. And I'll give the same speech over and over again. And I have a very enthusiastic running mate who seems weirder by the day, if I could steal his word. Bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Governor Chris Sununu, the 82nd governor of New Hampshire. But for now, let's talk to the person I can get a hold of right now, Charlie Hurd.
Your backup choice.
Right. I wouldn't say backup.
I mean, I was just walking down the street, and I got pulled in because you had nobody else to talk to. Nobody would talk to you.
And I should probably read the right hour. The bottom of the hour would be Josh Crash Hour. A different hour. I am going to have.
See, I like to open up for Josh because he is so much smarter than me.
Right.
You know what
deeper
really
thinking.
Stinks is is going after him because you know, I always learn something whenever he talks, but I also always feel dumber because I realize how much smarter some people are.
He is a very you don't see a lot of emotion flying, more clinical.
No, this is the benefit of having
these
so much
the Ben Carson.
Yeah, this is if you have that much knowledge in your brain,
yeah.
You don't have like a guy like me. I have to ride on emotion because it's like I got nothing else going on up there.
Which is why we have a special gift for you, Prevagen, which sponsors More to Know. It helps you with brainwaves.
Right now, I would settle for caffeine.
Caffeine.
Actually.
So what happened? You have caffeine?
No, I don't actually. This is herbal tea.
Why? What happened? You don't
nothing.
Feel
anything? No. I just haven't had coffee.
Have you tried to level off on the coffee?
Yeah, I'm trying to limit my intake of coffee.
Why? What happened?
Nothing. I think I just drink too much
coffee.
You
want to live? Yeah. Right.
I think caffeine's really good for you.
Well, I'm not too sure it's negative.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I don't think anything is. I think all this stuff is just ridiculous. I think that, you know, eggs are good for you one day, they're bad for you the next. No, eggs are good for you. I think that, you know, beef is good for you.
I'm really feeling, I'm going the other direction. And here's why.
You're a closet vegetarian, aren't you?
I don't have red meat. I don't have red meat. I have chicken, though. But I will say this. Are you finding out the processed foods? Does it bother you at all, some of the stuff that's coming out?
But it's always bothered me.
But you, and plus, if you're eating in the farm.
Yep.
You live on a farm, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so you could really appreciate what happens to food when it leaves
your place. I was drinking raw milk back before, like, that was even a thing.
Have I ever had raw milk? I probably never have had. I always go pasteurized, right?
Right. Well, the problem with and milk is good. Is good. Milk is always good. But the problem with boiled milk is it kills all the germs, but it also kills a lot of the good stuff too. And it's amazing what raw milk does for your body in terms of like skin, everything. It's really the health benefits are extraordinary. But it goes back to the whole process thing.
Well, that's the whole thing that. One of the things, if President Trump's looking to win over women, for the most part, if you go back to what RFK wants to do, it's what is with Casey Means and her have been talking about, the number one book in the country. And what they're trying to do is go back to eating right and get out of bed. They believe there's a big syndicate. I don't know if I'm willing to go there with Big Pharma. Let's get them eating crappy food. Let's get them taking medicine, diabetes medicine. And we'll make $1 zillion and keep America sick.
Well, not to get like too far off in this, but you know, is there a single industry that the federal government regulates that doesn't wind up capturing the agencies that regulate those areas in the economy? It doesn't exist. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, the Food and Drug Administration is set up in a way that makes it a whole lot harder for small independent, you know, the big food manufacturers are able to adhere to the rules of the system in a way that prevent, you know, my raw milk dealer got arrested by the federal government for selling raw milk across state lines.
Wow. That's
arrested.
Incredible.
Pre-dawn. He was an Amish guy and they busted down his front door did you know that the USDA has a SWAT team? They went in and they busted down his door. He was Amish. The Amish don't even go to they don't even go to the military. And they took away all of his raw milk. We had to pay his legal bills.
So let's talk about this. How do you feel about this? What Merrick Garland did the other day? He calls a press conference with Christopher Wray, who told the Russians to knock it off. So I think they probably will, because they really paid attention when Biden said don't. So now he said, knock it off. So basically.
So knock it off is don't plus. That's like the.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm sure you'll write about it in a column. So it turns out the Russians hired a Canadian who was working for RIT to work with some bloggers, influencers, and people like Dave Rubin to say, hey, would you write some positive stuff about Russia and negative stuff about Ukraine? And unwittingly, they thought they were working for a French billionaire. They're actually working for the Russian government, if we're to believe this story. So Dave Rubin, Tim Pool. I was going to say Chris Rufo, but Chris Rufo not involved.
Yeah.
And two others.
Yeah.
Now, number one, how do you feel about that? Number two.
I have a lot of questions.
Have we left out the Chinese and the Iranians? The Iranians who cyber attacked the Trump organization already, who are financing the protesters on these college campuses and these groups. There's no justice. There's no investigation into them.
Yeah, I have a lot of questions.
Go ahead.
One is why I would really love it if the FBI would focus on people who are committing crimes in the country. Whether it's, and not to be flip about it, but whether it's people who are trying to shoot a sitting president or somebody who's going into a school and shooting up a school. That's what I would like the FBI to protect my family and my friends from. This is kind of absurd. It's kind of, I didn't realize the power that Tim Pool had. I don't read a lot of his stuff. I don't read, but what I have read of his, I've never seen any sort of like weird Putin propaganda there. But also the idea that these guys are going to turn the election. Are you kidding me? This is absurd. And I think that and the idea that they're making such a big public deal out of it to me, makes me very suspicious that this is more right. about optics than it is about anything else.
So evidently, Liam Donovan is the husband of Lauren Chen, a Canadian influencer, has appeared as a guest on Tenet Media videos. Chen is affiliated with the conservative youth organization Turning Point and has hosted shows for Charlie Kirk. They also seem very interested in Dave Rubin, Tim Pool, Benny Johnson, who I don't know, and Lauren Southern, as I mentioned, and though Tyler Hansen and Matt Christensen. I am pretty amazed at the money. Megyn Kelly was talking about it yesterday, $400,000 a month.
Yeah.
To write positive things or say positive things about a certain
subject. But I don't think that individually. Not everybody.
I thought it was $400,000 was the offer
per,
a month.
Per person.
Person, yeah.
Yeah, that it's extraordinary. It's amazing. You would think that like if I were offered this, I would be a little
tempted.
Yeah, I would be tempted, but I would also ask some questions though.
Much more. Here's Tim Pool talking about. I guess is Eric. Is this one thing he was said, or is this commenting about it? Okay. Well, okay, go ahead.
This is psychotic. Ukraine is the enemy of this country. Ukraine is our enemy, being funded by the Democrats. I will stress this again. One of the greatest enemies of our nation right now is Ukraine. They are expanding this war. Now, don't get me wrong. I know you've got criminal elements of the U.S. government pushing them and guiding them and telling them what to do. Ukraine is now accused, a German warrant issued for blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline. Triggering this conflict. Ukraine is the greatest threat to this nation and to the world. We should rescind all funding and financing, pull out all military support, and we should apologize to Russia.
A little severe.
Yeah, that's Tim Pool. Yeah, so again, you know, do you think he changed a lot of minds there?
No.
I don't think that he's changing any minds there. But the idea, but stepping back and you know the bigger picture, the idea that there is a strain of you know in American politics right now, questioning whether we should be spending billions of dollars enforcing the boundaries, the borders of Ukraine when we're leaving our own borders wide open. I don't see that as necessarily Russian propaganda. As much as it is.
Well, if it's how you feel, it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Yeah.
And that's been argued a lot of people on the conservatives are not for this war. A lot of them. I'd say a third of conservatives not for the war. For me, I feel the inverse of what Tim Pool just said.
Right.
But that's fine. Right. But no one's paying me to say that. No one's paying you to say that.
Right.
And
I guess my point is that you know, there is a legitimate debate to be had about all this. And I don't think that just because they found some people to take $400,000, I don't think that they're not moving the needle. Here.
Right. I don't mind people pointing it out. I really don't.
Oh,
Dave Rubin, for example, is someone who I think he's got incredible integrity. And I think he was totally duped. But they said that they showed him a picture of this French billionaire that said, "Hey, I heard what you're doing. And I'd like to support you," and he's doing his own thing. So whatever the reason is, but I also think they used to took $1 million worth of Facebook ads, and they told us that's the reason Trump won. Now, that was in 2016. Now they're point out, you should find out where this money's coming from. If all of a sudden, if someone offered me $400,000 to say something, number one, I would know for sure that I would know fundamentally in my gut that this has got to be no good. Because number one, if I believe it, you're paying me $400,000 to say it while I'm employed, I'm like, no, thank you. And that's basically what Megyn Kelly said. Thank you. I appreciate it. I'll do what I want. Number two is I think that China is a much bigger threat. I think TikTok is a much bigger threat.
Oh, yeah.
Fundamentally, I don't trust him for a second. It's already been pointed out by Mike Gallagher, somebody I really trust. They already have Chinese Communist Party members sitting on the board of TikTok who decides where this is going. That they've done things that even TikTok USA doesn't know. Number three is I'm more concerned about Iran trying to kill President Trump, flat out kill him. They have assassins here, number one. Number two is they've already cyber attacked the Trump campaign. It's been confirmed. That to me should be the lead. And by the way, page 49 and 50 should be the Tim Pool, Dave Rubin story.
Yeah, and could you just explain to me, where are the American billionaires willing to pay $400,000 to pay a month to people to say nice things about the United States of America?
I would love to see that.
I would. I mean, and my email is.
I know.
chert@washingtontimes.com.
Right. $400,000, you would say nice things about America. Yeah. For $4, you would.
Right. In fact, I do currently right. for $4 a month.
Absolutely.
I say really nice things about America.
So we have a debate coming up. And I was talking to one high-ranking Trump official yesterday, and they said, it's everything. It's a really big deal. So, Charlie, in perspective, knowing that she's not going to sit down unless she has to, she's not going to have a press conference unless she absolutely has to, and there's not going to be another debate unless she absolutely has to, what's at stake?
So there's certainly the expectations game going on here. She is going to perform better than people are expecting based on – what we have seen from her when she does do these little asides.
Word salads,
it's terrible. But I do think that, and you know, the advantage for President Trump, former President Trump, is that he knows what he thinks. And going into these debates is a lot easier when you know what you think. When you're her, she doesn't know what she thinks. She changes her position all the time, and she says whatever she has to say in whatever room she's in to try to win over the people in that room. And so that's a really, really, really bad way to go into a debate. I think some good things will come out of it for the Trump campaign because she's going to wind up pinning herself down on things that are kind of not going to be helpful. And then they'll be able to cut ads out of it, which will be a very good thing. But the most important thing that I hope that President Trump is focused on is that she's very skilled at being annoying and getting under your skin. And we saw that with the 2020
Kavanaugh.
With the Kavanaugh thing, great example. We also saw it with the debate. If you go back and look at that debate with Mike Pence, you know, her interrupting him to get in his face. Excuse me, I'm talking, excuse me. You know, that kind of thing is going to Pence was pretty relaxed about it, right? But I don't, that's the sort of thing Trump has to be prepared for and not take the bait.
Well, I mean, what they're going to say, you know, Biden brought it up. He's like, well, you know, while your wife is pregnant, you have this thing going with Stormy Daniels. You've been indicted. You've been convicted on 34 felony accounts and those type things. Yeah. Gets him off. By the way, that might change with the Matt. Can you imagine if something happens in New York and they realize that immunity plays a role, especially with Hope Hicks?
Yeah.
Who was working for him at the time with the government. So if you throw that out. So if those convictions go up, you almost got to bake that in and you can't interrupt, which I think might be okay.
Sure.
Because you got the mics down. But would you turn around and just say, this is what your problem is. Do you debate the vice president that could walk away from the president's policies at any moment? Do you debate the senator, the most liberal senator, while she served for 3 or 4 years? Or do you debate the candidate, 2020 candidate in which he stood for? Do you debate somebody that signed off on the Inflation Reduction Act with the deciding vote? Are you debating somebody that believed that was a co-sponsor of the New Green Deal? Who are you debating? Yeah.
This is why I think at the end of the day that this campaign is actually going to come down to the ads. I think the ads are going to be really, really devastating. And I think that the Trump campaign will be able to pick up more because, you know, if she doesn't want to give anybody new footage of anything she's saying because she's hiding from the press, okay, well, then go back over the past 10 years of her career and pick out all the different things she said. And I think it's devastating because it goes to the heart of credibility. And her credibility when she tries to make these claims, which are immediately undercut by all the other things she said, it's absolutely devastating.
And the last straw was the straw. It is no longer the paper straw.
Yeah.
She's now back to plastic straws, Charlie Hurd. I don't know what to believe anymore. Thank you so much for joining me. You seem like a wonderful person. And remember, if you're Russian out there and you want to give Charlie
American.
If you're American and you want to give Charlie $400,000, he'll say nice things about America.
A month.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So listen to this. This is Kamala Harris a couple years ago. Cut three.
It's the president's vanity project.
His multi-billion-dollar vanity project called a wall is nothing more than a distraction. from the fact that he actually hasn't focused on working people in America. He contrived a national crisis.
So keep in mind, this person, who was a senator at the time, or vice president at the time, talking about the border wall, now backs finishing of the border wall. You understand? Thinks it should be battered. Not like her, not like a solid wall, but wants a ballad wall, kind of the one that's being built. She does an ad using Trump's portion of the border wall that he built in the ad. Now, I just got to ask you, I mean, the latest one, I wasn't kidding. The last straw was the straw story. The last straw was, she said, I told Aaron Burnett, everybody else, you got to use paper straws. Because plastic straws, they say, are bad for the environment. Well, the straws fall apart, you can't even use them, they don't even work. Now she's like, yeah, I'm all for plastic straws. That's a little thing. Building the wall is a big thing. No, Medicare for All is a big thing. She ran on that. She co-sponsored Medicare for All. So why would you ever elect somebody that will not define why they changed their mind?
Fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
If you tax unrealized gains, you're going to kill the stock market, right? And it's going to be the ultimate employment plan for private equity because companies are not going to go public because you can get whipsawed. Even though she's not directly conflicting the Biden tax plan, to her, her value proposition is we need to tax everybody fairly. I'm starting from the Biden plan as a starting point, but that's not necessarily her.
So she goes on to say, Mark Cuban is trying to call into CNBC because they were killing her on taxing on capital gains, the way she's ratcheting it up. Number one. Number two is on unrealized profits, on unrealized stock profits. They want to say if you have a company, it's worth $225 billion, right? You come out of nowhere. Then all of a sudden comes March, you got to pay taxes on it. Well, I can't afford to keep it. It's not my money. It's the value of a company I started. So the only thing I could do in order to pay my taxes is go sell my company, which means these corporations are going to get bigger and bigger. And the little guy and this young superstar lady inventing all this through R&D, hard work, hunches, and intellect and preparation, no one's going to own it except big corporations. It's an impossible thing, and that's why it might even be unconstitutional. How do you tax people on money you don't have? Josh Krashauer joins us now, Fox News Radio political analyst, also is a editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider. Josh, Mark Cuban went up to try to defend Kamala Harris. They ended up saying, listen, she has not fleshed out all of her beliefs, but she has up until the election day to do it. Does she really?
Well, I think that's the bet, Brian. I mean, we heard of the convention. Did we hear a lot of policy? No. Did we hear a lot of vibes? Yes. And so that's been the strategy. Now we have a debate on Tuesday where hopefully we get to really do more of a deep dive into where she actually stands on economic issues, whether, you know, where she stands on taxing capital gains. Mark Cuban has been, you know, akin to like a partisan Democrat lately. So, I think you have to take everyone's perspectives and opinions with a grain of salt, or at least knowing where they're coming from. He certainly is a Harris backer, and he's been, you know, very prolific on social media, aligned himself with the Democratic Party. So, you know, I think you have to kind of put that in context when you look at his defense of the vice president.
Right. I mean, he's anti-Trump is what you're saying. And it's almost like Liz Cheney, even though he was never a conservative, but he was out there on CNBC where they're the experts of the experts, just like we have Fox Business experts. You don't call in there unless you're willing to box someone your own, take on somebody your own weight. And they were. And they said, why don't you think she's not telling you anything you want to hear? Because you are a donor of hers, right? And he said, yeah, I am. So it's not in your interest. It's really not in your interest to get Kamala Harris elected, I don't think. But the job numbers aren't going to help, but the interest rate cut will help. But both yesterday spoke about their economic plans. First off, your take on what Trump presented.
Yeah, look, the argument, big picture argument that Trump has made and he gave it in the speech yesterday, is sort of deregulation and open up the markets. And sort of, if there's one classic traditional Republican element of the Trump agenda, it is on economics. The tax cut, I mean, obviously, the tax cuts are, if he gets elected, his tax cuts from 2017 are going to expire. So that's going to be a big economic debate in the next administration. And he wants to extend them. And he's been, you know, the candidate of a lot of, you know, business leaders, favor at least a tax cut policy. And I think that yeah, I listened to the speech. I think there were moments that were a little bit disjointed. There was talk about trade, talk about sanctions on foreign policy. But you know, I think the big picture, why a lot of business leaders are still with Trump, it's because of deregulatory policy and tax cuts.
Right. So addressing Wall Street VIPs, he said that he's going to put big tariffs on with a goal. A goal is to bring manufacturing back to the country. So if people realize they got to make it here because it's not going to be cheaper to buy it there, things will begin to reconfigure again since the 80s in free trade, which Republicans were slow to come around on. But now they pretty much, I don't know anybody that was for the TPP these days even brings it up. USMCA is a reconfigured trade deal. South Korea was a reconfigured trade deal. So we'll see where that goes. They had phase one of the China deal. Here is John Paulson. He's Trump's surrogate, big time, former head of Goldman Sachs. Cut 16.
I think Trump's plan is to turn the U.S. into a manufacturing powerhouse. Right now, we have a $1.2 trillion merchandise trade deficit. It's very unfair. By raising tariffs, we'll support American manufacturing, create more jobs here, more manufacturing here, and create more growth, higher wages, and turn America back into a manufacturing powerhouse.
So, I mean, that's his goal. And then he took some questions afterwards. And he's willing to run on that. Now, what she's doing is she is talking about a lot of things that she brings up aren't really that popular. Taxing unrealized gains, doubling taxes on capital gains right away. And then she says she wants to get rid of these tax cuts because they've only benefited billionaires. When basically the people that benefited most from the Trump tax plan, middle class people, 16% to 18%. Of middle-class people got a tax break or have more money because of that tax plan. Billionaires didn't do great, especially if you get rid of the SALT tax, which deducts from your mortgage, which all New York, which almost everybody in New York was getting a tax break on.
Yeah, so, I mean, to the first point, the other part of the Trump economic plan, the tariffs, the protectionism, I mean, that's a tougher sell in the business community. Paulson may be, you know, an exception to the rule, but you know, the general sense is that, you know, we live in a global marketplace and it's not good to kind of, I mean, but by the way, this is a bipartisan phenomenon. We saw the Biden administration reportedly trying to scuttle the Nippon Steel sale to Japan corporation. There's a lot of protectionism. There's a lot of populism in both parties, and Trump sort of, I think, led the way in his 2016 campaign, and that's where I think the political tides are heading. But certainly business leaders, many of them are skeptical about the economic benefits of that type of policy. You know, look, as far as the Harris bet on the tax cuts is that people don't care about corporate. I mean, they want corporation, you know, the general political sense that corporations need to pay higher taxes and pay their fair share. But it's a little harder to ask, you know, individuals and raise the income rate or revert to the old pre-Trump tax rates before 2017. So it's notable she's talking about capital gains, she's talking about corporate tax rate, which would go up under her plans, at least go up from where they were or where they are now. But she has not talked about sort of the individual tax cuts that were also a part of the Trump tax plan.
Does it bother you at all that she's taking the straw thing from Trump? She's taking the Nippon sale of U.S. Steel from Trump, that she's taking the tax on tips from Trump. Now she's even talking about building the wall and finishing the wall from Trump. I mean, this is insane. She doesn't say it. If she gives it in a speech, she has mostly surrogates talking about it. I've never heard this approach before.
Yeah, she's not as facile talking about economic policy. The debate's going to be a big test on that front. One thing on the politics front, Brian, is that if you look at the trends over the last couple decades, the Republican Party, which used to be the party of, you know, Chamber of Commerce, big business, corporate leaders, that you know, the wealthier Americans. The Democrats are now, if you look at the political affiliation of the wealthiest Americans, they're now much more likely to be Democrats. The corporate managers are much more likely to be Democrats than they were a couple decades ago. So, I mean, the Democratic Party is in sort of this weird position where, you know, they're historically like the populist sort of fighting for the working class. That's their image, self-image is about fighting for the working class. And they don't have a lot of working class Americans as part of their coalition anymore. So they're trying to still sound like the old Democratic Party. But their voter, you know, they also have to cater to like the, you know, a lot of business leaders are now voting more Democratic, and Republicans are doing much better with the working class. So it's sort of under the radar realignment that's really making a lot of the economic rhetoric a little bit muddled.
So we'll see. Would you say that, I don't know what the bump was from the DNC, but they've had momentum through August, no question. So because it's not Joe Biden, now should the 59-year-old going against the 78-year-old. And you have somebody who has more money than now has raised more money than President Trump. And in the seven battleground states, most of them are too close to call. Wisconsin looks like she might be pulling away. Michigan, it's to her advantage. But in Arizona, in Georgia, in North Carolina, and now a dead heat in Pennsylvania and Nevada, Trump is more than in contention. Some he's either tied or winning.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, very close race. I mean, I think if the polls are to be believed and they hold into November, we could be looking at the closest battle for the presidency since the 2000 cliffhanger with Al Gore and George Bush. We're going to have a late election night, election week. We're going to be counting votes in Pennsylvania and Georgia, potentially be well beyond election night. So, I mean, I think the Trump hope, the Trump bet is – They're well within striking distance of Kamala Harris in the polls. And in 2016 and in 2020, the polls pretty dramatically underestimated the degree of the Trump turnout, the Trump base. And if that error replicates itself in 2024, then Trump wins this election. But I don't think you can automatically assume that's going to be the case. And the pollsters have changed their modeling, and you know things change. In 2022, actually, they underestimated Democratic turnout. So there's a lot of variables at play. If you look at the polls at face value, we're in a very, very close race. And if you think that there's a secret sort of Trump bump that's going to happen on Election Day, then he's got to be feeling pretty good.
And most people think he's underperforming. And the mindset of the Kamala Harris side is that they're underdogs. They keep saying that. Most important issue is the economy. They're never going to grade higher than Trump on the economy, but they want to close the gap. When it comes to women, the gap is widening. I think one thing, a sleeper issue, could be this whole RFK food thing and trying to get people healthy again. And I'm wondering if that might play a role in getting some of the female vote back if they start trumpeting that.
Yeah, I mean, boy, one of the storylines of this election is just the gaping gender gap, which has always been the case in Trump elections in the last decade. But boy, I mean, you look at the men love Trump and the women love Harris. And that's just it creates just a very, very polarized campaign and polarized electorate.
What is your prediction for the debate? How does it play out in your mind?
I think you mentioned the expectations game, Brian, that everyone's trying to lower expectations. Look, Harris, I would say she, at least in her 2020 debate against Mike Pence, she played it to a draw. So she's a prosecutor. She's used to kind of, you know, giving sort of those courtroom speeches that are often translate effectively into the debate stage. So, you know, I think Harris probably has a slight advantage, but Trump did well at that first debate. He beat expectations, and Biden certainly had such a bad performance, he had to drop out of the race. So, I think the big question for Trump, I would say two things. The big question for Trump is whether he can be self-disciplined enough not to get interrupt her and have a little bit of discipline during the debate. And I think, the big question for Harris is, if you look at the polls, no one really knows who she is. Like, they know she's vice president. They know she ran for president. She's pretty progressive. But this is her first chance to really put some meat on the bones, policy-wise. So she has a lot at stake. Like, she gives a good impression. I think she's in pretty good shape in this election. But I think a lot of people who didn't like her a few months ago, now they think she's okay. This is a big test for her that went over those skeptical voters.
I think she starts off strong, but the unscripted portion is where she can get weak. It's almost like the analogy is the San Francisco 49ers during the Bill Walsh days used to script the first 7, 10, 20 plays. But then when the game gets going, you have turnovers, weather conditions, the other team has a say in that, the referee, the fumbles. And then all of a sudden things get off the script, and then you find out how good the team is. I think she'll start off strong. She'll anticipate where they're going to begin. And then when it gets to the 2 minutes, the follow-up, the accusations back and forth, I think that's a little different. Also, are the moderators going to say, do a Candy Crowley and decide to instantly fact-check? Are they going to let each candidate say anything? Best economy ever, worst economy ever. Best foreign policy, worst foreign policy. Unemployment was lower than it was. It was 9.8%. So what, like, are they going to start weighing in there and asserting themselves?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. The moderators can set the tone of a debate. And this one's on ABC News. It'll be a big question. I assume the economy is actually going to play a pretty central role. That's the biggest issue for most Americans. And how you frame the questions, like whether we talk a lot about inflation, which is an issue that is driving a lot of the support for Donald Trump, like that's going to make a big difference in how people read the debate or how receive the aftermath of the
and
debate.
If you wonder why it seems like she's got momentum and she's been doing everything right, how about this? The Media Research Center does a poll. They looked at what PBS does. 88% of the coverage on Kamala Harris has been positive. 72% of the coverage on Donald Trump's been negative. If this country is really 50, is it possible that 7 out of every 10 things you do is bad? And is it possible that 9 out of every 10 things you do is good? Not on this planet, unless you got some implicit bias. I mean, that's what probably every Republican, but especially Trump, has to overcome. But Josh, I've never seen it like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some thinking in the Harris camp that they can just run to make a football analogy. They're running the prevent defense, holding on to a very, very narrow lead and hoping that the press doesn't really scrutinize them on where they stand and some of the flip-flops that have come up, throughout the campaign. So, yeah, I mean, this is ultimately, though, I mean, the Trump campaign has to litigate the case themselves. They can't. Republicans have never been able to rely on a little bit of home field advantage from the media. It's always been on the burden on the campaigns to make the case and to report on or to attack the candidate on the issues that the media may not be covering aggressively.
Josh Krasshauer, thanks so much. Josh, it's going to be an interesting weekend and week.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Brian Kilmeade Show, back in a moment.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hunter decided to enter his plea to protect those he loves from unnecessary hurt and cruel humiliation. This plea prevents that kind of show trial that would have not provided all the facts or served any real point in justice.
That is Abby Lowell ridiculously saying that Hunter Biden was magnanimous and self-effacing and thinking of family first when he decided not to go through with this trial. Now, you pay Abby Lowell $1 zillion, but somebody else's money. I'm not sure how that's done. You do it through a movie producer who doesn't even seem as though he has much money, but he's paying for a guy he barely knows. I thought, now that I'm sure they became friends, now that he lives with him, Hunter Biden, using his money, pays Abby Lowell and then decides, I'm just going to say I'm guilty because I don't want my parents to have to go through this. Really? How about this? How about as they unwind, how much money you owe in taxes, they have to find out how much money you earned. And as they try to find those bank lines and those storylines and find out where these checks have come from, they realize you owe much more than $1 million. How about 27, 30 million? Then you realize maybe Hunter doesn't owe this money. Maybe they paid Hunter, but then he paid other people. Who are those other people? Might they be your 8-year-old niece that you're hiding money with? Might they be Jim Biden? Might they go to the actual former president's trust or account or his stepmom, Jill? That is the reason, in my view, he didn't want the forensics to happen with the Justice Department resources. But he wasted a lot of money. He wasted a lot of time. And we know what's going to happen. He's going to get a pardon. And it's going to be another one of those lies that Joe Biden's going to get a pass on. Said over and over again, my son's not getting a pardon. Of course he's getting a pardon. Wasting time and money. The privileged kid continues to get his own way.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show as we close out a wild week. Shannon Bream is standing by. Governor Chris Sununu, the 82nd governor of New Hampshire, is going to be here. A great person to break down where we're at right now. It does not look like New Hampshire is going well for the former president. I thought he had a shot at winning it, shot at winning Virginia and Minnesota. That's changed because Joe Biden has proven unworthy of even serving today in the Oval Office, let alone 4 more years. So we have a debate coming up on the 10th. Today, it looks like Secretary of Defense Austin will meet with Ukrainian officials. It's going to be the beginning of an opening up and a plea for Zelensky, from Zelensky, to take the handcuffs off and allow him to penetrate against the Russians in their own land with our weapons, because they have a plan to win. And he's already shown he could take a portion of that country. We'll discuss that. But for now, before we get to Shannon, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The GBI has arrested Colin Gray in connection to the shooting here at Appalachie High School. Colin is Colt Gray's father. He is charged with the following: 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter.
Yeah, there you go. Chris Hosey was talking about the investigation of the Georgia shooting. Not only is the shooter in custody, already confessed, by the way, but his father's in jail, too, charged with second-degree manslaughter. Why? This is a much bigger story than just a tragic Georgia school shooting. Plus, an AP tarred J.D. Vance. You're not going to believe it.
Number two.
Again, I think it's important to call out those foreign actors, but to simply isolate it as this one specific issue when we know that every other country out there is probably trying to interfere. I think it's important to be very aware, not just of Russia.
Lydia Moynihan talks about Russia, Russia, Russia. Yes, the new Attorney General Merrick Garland do what the old one did, and that says Russia's already infiltrating into our elections. All right, great. But what about Iran? What about China? Why does it always have to be only Russia? Don't you know there's inherent distrust among Trump supporters when all you point out is Russia?
Number one.
In those roles, I took on perpetrators of all kinds.
Predators who abused women. Fraudsters who ripped off consumers. Cheaters who broke the rules for their own gain.
Right, that is the same speech that Kamala Harris gives all the time. Who is the crime fighter, Kamala Harris? Not the one she bills herself as. We have the elusive backstory and track record as we piece together both the Trump and Harris economic plans that they think could bring them victory. Shannon Bream, Fox News Sunday, Fox News chief legal correspondent, best-selling author. Shannon, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, Brian.
Shannon, first off, today, if you could clarify this for me, I understand the Trump team has asked for the New York judge to throw out the conviction, but mostly wants the sentencing to be moved. Are both things happening today? Is the judge deadline to reconsider those things today? It was September 18th is sentencing.
Right. If it is, it's a self-imposed deadline that Merton, he signaled yesterday within the last couple of days that he's going to make a decision today. Now, we know in the past, there are some orders and things that he's done in the cases that haven't been immediately publicly released. But it sure sounded like from his office yesterday that he may be telling us today what his decision is on whether to sentence on September 18th or push it back.
Right. But what about looking at the role of this new Supreme Court immunity ruling? For example, Hope Hicks was working for the White House when whatever she did, she was asked to testify about. So should that be thrown out? Should the interaction with Mike Pence be thrown out? When do we get that?
That's what Jack Smith did in this federal case. I mean, he said, all right, we're going to go back through. We think we have tough enough facts without those personal things that we're going to take them out, resubmit. This is a whole new indictment. Whether that happens in New York still remains to be seen. I think that's going to take a little bit longer. I'd be surprised if Merchan told us today that he made a decision on that. I sensed that that was going to be more of what he was planning to do on the 16th. But one of the things that Trump team has complained about is that whatever he decides on that immunity issue, they need to have enough time to appeal that before they're then immediately thrown into sentencing. So, it's totally up to the judge what he does, but I think we may have to wait a little bit longer to find out where he is on that immunity thing.
If Pass give us an idea, he had no problem. And Alvin Bragg says, I'm not going to stand in your way. If you want to delay sentencing, delay. Is that significant when the attorney general has no problem with it?
Well, see, that's the thing. If both sides are saying, like, yeah, we're okay with the delay, or we want a delay, or there's no objection from the prosecution, then it puts a spotlight on Marshawn, because if he moves forward with that September 18th date for the sentencing, it's going to feed into the argument from the Trump team that this whole thing has been political. So you would think, for Marshawn's own sake, he would want to take that out of the conversation, out of the calculation, and say, like, okay, look, I'm neutral. This is not going to happen until after the election. I think if he goes before that, it is going to bolster that argument from the Trump team that this has been a political prosecution and persecution.
So we know the other story, the tragic shooting that happened this week in the Georgia high school. Turns out this kid was interviewed before last year, and they came by and they talked to Colin Gray, the dad, and they talked to the son about the fact that they found threats online that he was issuing. But for some reason, the FBI said they agreed he was hacked, and they couldn't really say for sure whether the threats came from him. Listen to this interaction. Cut 26.
He knows the seriousness of weapons and what they can do and how to use them and not use them. So it's kind of a little bit of a shock. So in whatever y'all are telling him, please instill in him that what if this is whatever or wherever this is coming from, it's no joke.
No.
Like, it's no joke.
Well, we wouldn't be here if it was.
No, I know. I know. And I'm telling you right now, we talk about it quite a bit. Okay. All the school shootings, things that happen.
Yeah,
all, scary. Hey, are you getting picked on at school? He is. He's getting picked on at school. And is everything okay? That's why I keep going up there.
No.
You know, because you just never, you never really know. And I don't want anything to happen to him. So, yeah.
Yeah, he was getting picked on at school. He had a horrific, his mom addicted to drugs, huge rap sheet. And now we find out that neighbors have said these kids were always dirty, one sometimes banging on the door to get in. Mom, let me in, let me in. And then the dad, as you hear, talking with FBI agents on this investigation, but it looks as though he still bought his son a rifle.
Yeah, and I think that's where we get into this new legal territory that we've seen in the last year and now in this Georgia case where parents are being charged legally. I mean, this dad is facing up to 180 years, I think it is, in jail over this because, you know, they're going to argue, prosecutors, that there is a moral obligation for you to know what is going on with your children. If you're going to have guns in the house, if you're going to gift them guns, you have to have some level of responsibility for thinking that a minor is capable of these things. Now, listen, where I grew up in the South, everybody had guns. I mean, minor kids had guns, they hunted with them, duck hunting or whatever it was, and there weren't, you know, in my experience, the people I grew up with, they did not, you know, get involved with school shootings or violence or that kind of thing. So I know it may seem odd to some people for younger people to have firearms, but not common where I came from. But if you know your child has been questioned by legal authorities for potentially threatening a school shooting, it does not seem like a good use of judgment to provide them with additional guns. And he would have had to buy the ammo. You can't buy that when you're underage. If the kid got his hands on that, it had to come as a purchase from the dad or someone else.
Yeah. What about the fact that J.D. Vance came out and said, says he laments that school shootings have become a fact of life and says U.S. needs to harden security to prevent this from happening. And then the headlines in the AP is saying school shootings are, J.D. Vance says school shootings are facts of life. So, and all of a sudden it looks like he's being callous and indifferent.
Right.
They quickly had to change that headline. But man, that very rarely happens on the other side.
Well, and the thing is, too, I mean, once you read it in context or hear what he said, obviously it's very different than the tone of what the headline was. And even though the AP corrected and, like, Politico, of all people, called them out on it, it already had gone viral. You know how many people had tweeted it, how many people had seized on it, including, like, people supporting the Harris-Walz campaign. And how do you unring that bell? I mean, it's still out there all over the internet as if he said it the way the AP headline originally suggested.
So we know that our elections are targets of infiltration. We have Iran, who's already cyber attacked the Trump campaign. China never stops. And now Russia's back. Big indictment a couple of days ago. Vladimir Putin sees this and was asked about it in Mongolia, one of the few countries that would allow him to visit. Cut 28.
As for the favorites, there is no need to define that. It's a choice by the people of America in the end. I've said that our so-to-say favorite was the acting president, Mr. Biden. He's been taken out of the race, but he advised all his supporters to support Mrs. Harris. That's what we'll do. We'll support her as well, and that's the first thing. Secondly, her laugh is so expressive and infectious, that means she's doing well.
So I know sarcasm, even in Russian, through a translator with a silky clear voice. That is hysterical. As much as I despise Vladimir Putin, that is hysterical.
Well, and I did. That was my first thought, is like, did something get lost there in translation, or is he just being a world-class
troll? He's trolling.
At this point, yeah. To say that her laugh is infectious and delightful or whatever, you know, the things that he said. I don't know how that translates. In Russian, listen, this is a bad dude. We know that, you know, he kills people. He attacked Ukraine. He's taking sovereign territory. But he's also clearly, I think, responding to all of this DOJ saying, yes, Russia's the bad actor. We've arrested these people and gone after them. But like you said, there are other bad actors out there who want to sow chaos and want to upend what's going on here. A lot of people would say, could we focus on China as well? You know, the whole debate we've had over TikTok and the disinformation and misinformation that's aimed at making us in America like hate each other and, you know, throwing people to the wrong place for websites and for positions and what really candidates stand for. I mean, it's not just Russia. So I hope the DOJ is also casting a wider net to other bad actors out there.
Absolutely. So, Shannon, the Hunter Biden, I'm guilty. On second thought, I'm guilty. And now Abby Lowell has to explain it away. So this is a shock to many people that he'd make this. But Alan Dershowitz says he predicted it. Listen, cut 37.
I predicted from the beginning, of course, that he was going to plead. He has no option but to plead. The case against him is overwhelming. But it was mishandled from the very beginning. Now, I know Abby Lowell is a good lawyer. So I suspect that the wrong decisions made in this case, and they're wrong from top to bottom, were made by Hunter Biden himself, perhaps from the White House. But nobody who is pleading, who is going to plead, would wait so long. You usually plead early to get a good deal. You try to get the 2 points.
So why did he wait, Shannon? Why? I mean, what do you, knowing how well you know all these players, what was his advantage of paying all this money for a lawyer, marching him out there, traveling him out there, getting up yourself, going out to Los Angeles, and then just saying, without a deal, I'm just telling you I'm guilty.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. And a couple of things struck me yesterday. First of all, they were supposed to start the jury selection yesterday. It gets real when you know that's going to happen. And remember, last week, the judge in that case, Mark Scarsi, also issued an order saying all of the salacious stuff that the government wants to bring in, you know, strip clubs and payments to prostitutes and all this other kind of stuff, if he was taking, as alleged, some of that stuff as a business expense, then the jury has a right to hear about it. So as much as Hunter's team had fought that, they knew the very real possibilities they were going to have to deal with all of that stuff being aired out. You heard Hunter's statement where he said, I don't want to put my family through this again. There's also the broader question of, was there going to be potential evidence brought in that dealt more broadly with the Biden family, with James Biden and other payments and other questions? It's all a huge headache that I think that, you know, at the end, Hunter was like, I don't want to run this gauntlet again.
Yeah, I think it's he just knows he's getting a pardon. There's no way he's not.
I mean, come on, you're a dad. Is there any way if your kid was assigned multiple years in jail or whatever potential sentence he faces on these two federal charges, I mean, the gun charges and the tax charges, two different sets. I mean, I think every American will understand that if Joe Biden goes back on his word and as he walks out the door says, I'm pardoning my son.
But Shannon, he has no problem going back on his word. Remember, he said he had nothing to do with his son's business dealings, never talked about it. Now they're intimately involved in it. The laptop was not his. 51 Intel agents, he knew it was his son's laptop. All he had to do was ask him. They had that conversation. He had no problem to flat out lying. And then when he says, I'm not going to pardon my son, he knows that's a lie. KJP knows it's a lie. If you just said, I'll have to see when I get there. My goal now is to get Kamala Harris elected. Mm-hmm. I get that. But to say no and just to reverse himself, I think is a finger in the eye of the American people. But who's going to be on your show Sunday?
Well, we are going to have Senators Murphy and Cornyn. You got both sides of the aisle represented to talk about the campaigns, about the economic plans, about the border, about the fact that we're about to run out of money again here in Washington. It's something we like to do every couple months. So lots to discuss with them. We're also going to have Jim Messina and Brett O'Donnell. They both have done campaign prep for Dems, for R's at the presidential level, at the debates. Who needs to do what? Who is in potential trouble? Where are the landmines? We'll talk with them about that and much more.
That'll be great. And on One Nation, being that you haven't really asked
Saturday
yet.
Saturday night.
Yeah, Casey Mears is going to be with us. Means is going to be with us, rather. She's going to be talking about what's in our food and how it relates to Big Pharma. We're also going to have Joe Brown, The judge has known Kamala Harris when she was an up-and-coming DA in San Francisco and has some pointed opinions about what her track record actually is. That, to me, is going to be fascinating. Mm-hmm. I would not be surprised if you put it in your show on Sunday. I'm not pressuring you.
And I'm just saying, if you could give me, podcast. You know, some sneak preview, we might be able to do that.
Right. Maybe I'll do that. And then, of course, we've got the Ruthless podcast. And Kayleigh McEnany, who is really not a nice person, but I just think she's very good on TV.
My personal experience.
Really?
Yeah, I will debate you on that.
All right.
I think that she's excellent. And by the way, if you're talking about food, will there be a cooking segment? Because I feel like that's something you could add to the show.
Right. You know how I feel about cooking on television.
You love it and embrace it because it's part of Fox and Friends on a regular basis.
But here's the thing, Shannon. Do you know who loves cooking? It turns out the person who wants to be president. That's all she talks about. She talks about spices.
Okay, well, maybe you could have her on for a cooking segment.
She'll probably do that.
The door is always open for One Nation or for Fox News Sunday. Come on down, Vice President.
Shannon Bream, I'm going to check my local listings.
Okay, please do that, and I'll see you Saturday night.
All right, check out my TV guide right now. Back in a moment.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So WRBA is kind enough to carry the show. We've been thrilled to be there for the last few months. And I did an event immediately when they started carrying us in Richmond, Politics and Pints. And now it's back for another right before the election. November 5th is the election. October 16th is Politics and Pints. Go down, drink a little, talk a little. It's at the Beacon Theater in Hopewell, Virginia, 401 North Main Street. We were there before. Is this the same venue?
I believe it's the same venue.
Yeah, it's the same venue.
And last time the VIP tickets sold out like the day the tickets went on sale. So if you want to go and get the VIP tickets, you should log on right now.
This whole thing sells out quickly.
It does. It's a very fun event.
Yeah, so it's going to be great. The whole lineup will be there. And it'll be great. And the beer, do we get free beer or do we get
you might get free beer, but I think people who attend might not be getting free beer.
Right. You know, I have that idea that I should never get on stage or go behind a microphone or on camera having drank ever.
Yes, that is in your head. You won't. You won't touch a sip of alcohol until after you come off stage.
And then I will.
And then you pound away.
And you know why.
Why is that? I know why, but tell the listeners, yes.
Well, my feeling is if I do great after a few drinks, then I'm going to feel like I got to drink every time.
Even though you've learned that you've been great stone sober.
Oh, that's very nice of you. That is very nice.
You need to drink after that.
But imagine if I was better drunk. I mean, isn't that how?
Well, why don't we do an experiment? Why don't you have a few beers before Politics and Pints so we can find out?
I don't know. I just read all those stories about Johnny Carson when he used to drink and not be responsible and get kind of angry. And it just ends up going down a rabbit hole.
So you think that will happen to you?
He ended up divorced a few times. But he ended up being the most famous person in the country. So I don't know.
The pro and the con.
Can I think about it in the break?
You can think about
it. Politics and Pints coming up. It's October 16th.
We drank beer. We like beer.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think what's also really remarkable about this is, like, I mean, you heard her talking about it there, the Trump's wall in his campaign during his presidency. There was really no greater symbol of Trump's presidency than the wall and the way that Democrats were attacking him over the wall and his restrictive immigration policies. So we looked in that ad, and if you look at it, that exact area of wall is in Sasabe, Arizona, and that is a portion of wall that was actually built by Donald Trump. It was built in an area where there was not previous wall. It was actually pretty controversial when they were building it at the time. So just to see that. And then there are other.
She's using his wall that he built to say, look at what I did.
It's amazing. And that was on CNN. Andrew Kaczynski just going over the campaign ad that she's running, that she's actually wants to be strong at the border using Donald Trump's wall that he built in order to say that she's going to be strong on the border and she's going to get bipartisan immigration deal done. She's also just flipped on straws last night. You might not think it's a big deal, but it just shows you everything. Oh, I'm taking those no taxes on tips. That's going to be mine. I know what the next thing she's going to do. That thing that Trump came up with that might pissed off, ticked off the IVF, the pro-life group, is who's mysteriously are against IVF, which is stunning to me and stupid. But he's saying that if I want to get the health insurance to pay for IVF, it's going to cost trillions. Maybe we can't afford it. But the idea, I think, is solid. I know she's going to take that. Governor Chris Sununu is experienced between his dad and his brother as anybody. Governor, there's a lot of things that I could have predicted when Harris came in stunningly and took over for Biden. I did not predict her taking Donald Trump's issues. That caught me by surprise. What about you, Governor Sununu?
Hey, the Harris border wall sounds good to me. I mean, what a joke. What a joke. So here's what I mean, when I'm talking to folks on the ground, there's, you know, two main issues that we always talk about, right? Cost of living, right? Who's going to be the change agent to lower my cost of living? It's not the economy. It's not tariffs. It's not even job creation. That's a big thing. But on these, all this hypocrisy we're seeing in the past 30 days, unbelievable. Is she going to be called out on it at the debate? That's going to be – because we all know the debate is a big moment for both of them. Are the moderators going to say, hey, look, you literally put Donald Trump's wall in your commercials, and 3 years ago you literally, you know, said X, Y, and Z.
You said it was a medieval vanity project.
Yeah. So is she going to be called out on it? Because I'll tell you, the one thing Trump should not do is just say, I wanted the wall, she didn't want the wall, and move on. Someone has to bring up the 2 seconds, the two lines of specifics to show the average American who, you know, we're wonky, right? You know, we're in this. We watch this all the time. Most Americans are actually just trying to get through their lives. So to show these direct hypocrisies, I think, is going to be very powerful because she's not going to have an answer. That's the moment that's the most critical thing. She's going to do this swirly, you know, in a circle, 30,000-foot gobbledygook answer and look foolish. But she has to be called out on it. So if the moderators aren't doing it, I hope the president, former president himself, does it, because she's in a real pickle. The question I have is this. Did they know what they were doing? Did they know when they paid this commercial how stupid of a move this was? Or are they just that dumb on the campaign that they didn't realize? I don't know. That's the thing the background thing that I've been scratching my head on.
There's so much going on. Now, for example, I'm looking back at her track record. I mean, do you know that she had up this rule in 2005 when she was DA over in San Francisco, where until you commit 3 crimes, you don't go to jail?
Well, look, we're talking about someone that said, how dare you say Merry Christmas? I mean, you're scolded people for saying the hypocrisy of this individual. And I always say this when people say, oh, we're so excited about Kamala Harris. They said, really? Well, what did she do as senator? What did she do as senator that got you really excited? Well, you know, she's not Biden. If the best argument they have is you're not Joe Biden, holy cow. It's just a reminder that she was – why she was the most unpopular vice president, the history she has of the activism but not the results, right?
She lost to a 76-year-old that wouldn't leave his basement, right?
I mean – No, came in last place to a 76-year-old that wouldn't leave his basement.
Yeah, did not get to New Hampshire, did not get to Iowa. So back in 2005, the police chief warned – DA Harris that her proposal policy would allow narcotic sellers to immediately be released back onto the streets without consequences, encouraging dealers to come to San Francisco, potentially increasing violent crime in the city. She says that she was for 3 times getting arrested. The police chief pushed back on her. She's always, for the most part, been soft on crime. She also talked about, you know, it, to say you need more cops on the street is being outdated. It's actually wrong and backward to think more police officers will bring more safety. I mean, you can't say that you're strong on crime and have this type of track record. Change your mind without saying it only through surrogates. Out of everything your dad, brother, and you have done, I don't think anyone's ever done anything like this.
No, and so the question is, will she get away with it, right? I mean, will the American people buy it? I don't think so, especially in the swing states, because I've always said this week is her high watermark, right? The honeymoon's over, right? And I don't know about many of you, you get back from the honeymoon, guess what? You got to go back to work. You got to, you know, go back to doing the chores. Vacation's over. You got to earn it. And she doesn't have any sort of record of earning. You know, the other thing I think I'll say this just from someone who I really focus on the blocking and tackling of campaigns and what you have to do, the value of messaging. Her team is doing this massive disservice to her. The fact that they don't let her go out in front of the press, her own team is telling her, you're not good. You can't handle it. we don't trust you. Otherwise, they would tell her to go do more. And what happens is there's no practice, right? You have to practice getting in front of the media, taking questions, being, you know, smooth on your feet, how to express yourself in the moment. That is not a natural thing. It takes practice. So they're preventing her from doing any practice. She's going to be standing there on that debate stage all on her own. And she's going to be scared because her own team has told her, you're not good enough to take on Trump. Right. And you're not good enough to answer these questions. And there really is no answer for this hypocrisy that we're throwing out there. So I think she's in real trouble. I think they had an opportunity to set her up for success. I think she's in real trouble, both on the campaign side and then just the fact that, you know, nobody wants the most liberal senator in history as your president. That's extremism. Right. And America doesn't want that. They want someone who's going to bring peace across the world with all these issues that we're dealing with, whether it's the Ukraine, whether it's in the Middle East. Hey, by the way, let's not forget what China's doing in Taiwan. Quietly, China has pushed on Taiwan as strong as they ever have. I was just with the ambassador of Japan yesterday, and he said, you know, America's looking over here while China's doing this over there. You need strength in the White House. You need the Donald Trump strength in the White House that can actually, you know, bring some peace by, again, asserting our strength with our allies, that we're not going to leave them on the heels, and put fear into our enemies. Right? Who did Putin endorse? I love that one. Putin has actually endorsed Kamala Harris. There you go. That's an end game. That's an end. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, this was Vladimir Putin, who was commenting in Mongolia because it's a beautiful time of year to go to Mongolia. The kids are back in school. And this is where you like to go. There's a wonderful strips there. So here's what he said when asked about infiltrating the election.
As for the favorites, there is no need to define that. It's a choice by the people of America in the end. I've said that our so-to-say favorite was the acting president, Mr. Biden. He's been taken out of the race, but he advised all his supporters to support Mrs. Harris. That's what we'll do. We'll support her as well, and that's the first thing. Secondly, her laugh is so expressive and infectious, that means she's doing well.
I mean, is that unbelievable?
I mean, look, Putin is only going to advocate in his own interests, and he knows it is in Russia's interest to put Kamala Harris in the top spot in the White House because he's had his way with this administration to date, and he's going to keep doing it. It's her administration, right? It ain't Biden's. I mean, let's be honest. Do any of us think he's been making the tough decisions in the White House? No, it's hers, and she owns it, and Putin loves it. So if there's anything that defines Kamala Harris's problem, both on the international stage, her weakness here within the country, is the fact that really one of our number one enemies right now, the person who fears America's support across the world the most, is Vladimir Putin, and he's all behind Kamala. That's troubling.
Governor, why do you think the vice president was making her economic speech in New Hampshire? Because his word is that she's got about a 5-point lead on the Real Clear average, and the Trump team is being urged to kind of pull up stakes and focus elsewhere. Your thoughts?
Oh, no, this is going to be a one or two-point race either way. In New Hampshire? Oh, absolutely, and she knows that. She knows they've done internal polling on their side. They know how bad the concept of price control is. We're very pro-business here. We're very pro-small business and mid-sized business. And when she started talking about price controls a month ago, all the small businesses went, uh-oh, we're going to get crushed. That basically destroys competition, destroys innovation, destroys entrepreneurship, and only the big companies will survive, right? It makes no sense. And so here in New Hampshire, everyone heard that. I mean, it really did. They really did. And so I think they realized, holy cow, that message is not playing well. We've been very strong on it here. Trump only lost here by a couple thousand votes in 2016. I mean, it was effectively a tied race, right? And Hillary Clinton just barely pulled it out. This race is going to be a lot more like 2016. We're going to have a great ticket down ballot, not just with former President Trump on top, but the Republican down ballot in New Hampshire is very, very strong. They know that. And so they're not giving up. My sense is you'll see former President Trump back here doing a couple of his rallies and things like that. So
evidently, he was angry when word got out that he was being urged to by a staffer to give up on New Hampshire. So he was right to be angry. What does he have to do to win it?
Just show up. I mean, really, being on the ground in New Hampshire is the most important thing. Commercials are fine, you know, whatever. You know, we know who he is. We want you to show up and just know that you have an open ear, right? An open ear to what's really happening on the ground, not just to your staff and what's going on in D.C., but what's really happening on the ground. That's why he was very successful here in 2016. He did. I'm not saying he's got to just do the living room parties like, you know, when you're first starting out. But really, to be here, to do a couple retail stops would make all the difference in the world. And again, if her high watermark in New Hampshire is 5 points, this is well within her grasp. We're going to have a very strong ticket. I think Trump knows that. And by the way, the urging of the staffer with some volunteer out of Massachusetts, let's be honest, Massachusetts doesn't know anything about New Hampshire politics. Let's just start that right there. And so that, I think there was a, you know, that was a bunch of internal nonsense. My sense is he'll be here. They're not giving up. We're the diamond in the rough in the Northeast, right? We're holding our own as a red state in the Northeast. He knows he can win here, and it's important. It's important to lay that groundwork because, by the way, if he were to lose Pennsylvania, he can still win if he has New Hampshire, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, right? So our four electoral votes would put him at 272. So I think they're doing that electoral math, and they'll put the effort here that they need to win it.
All right. How valuable would Nikki Haley be? She's back from Taiwan. She went there herself a couple of weeks ago. She's supposed to be maybe doing our show, Fox and Friends, on Monday. Don't you believe, or do you believe, that it would do good for Trump to start putting her into play like they're doing RFK?
Look, Nikki can only help. There's no question about that.
What about in New Hampshire, too?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, she almost beat him here in New Hampshire. So she just has a lot of support here. Now, all those Nikki voters, I do believe they're going to go with Trump. Like, there's no question. But, you know, when you add, it's not just Nikki Haley. It's all these other supporters. It's Nikki and RFK Jr. are completely different. But what they show is a spectrum of support, yeah. Right? Not just from what the liberal media likes to call the MAGA conservatives, not just from moderates, not just, I mean, all across, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, all across the spectrum of folks that just care about this country are galvanizing because they know how important it is to make sure Kamala Harris and this administration gets moved on. So Nikki can only help. I mean, it's really up to the campaign how, you know, how they want to use her and that. But at the end of the day, I think most of Nikki's voters are here. It's just about getting that. It's about an 8.5% of the swing voters. They're waiting to see which candidate can bring peace to the world and drop their cost of living. And if you can focus on those two issues, those 8% are very gettable.
I know you know the governor as well. Here's Governor Tim Walz, the running mate, obviously, saying that he's getting under Trump's skin. Cut 10.
There's a saying in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. But I want to say this. I did watch part of it last night. 11 times. Donald Trump explained to us that he wasn't weird. Okay.
All right, so he says he's getting under Trump's skin. Your thoughts about the Governor Walz that you know?
Look, Tim's a nice guy, but look what he did to his state. I mean, the record speaks for itself, right? So, no, Trump could care less about Walz. I mean, if there's anybody Trump doesn't care about, it's that guy. And just, again, look at his record. Look what happened during COVID. Look what happened during the riots of 2020. Look what happened when his cities were burning and they didn't even try to control it for the longest of times, right? He didn't support his police. He didn't put his National Guard out there. Public safety is real. I don't care what party you're from. You want to know your kids can walk to school safely. You want to know that law enforcement isn't picking up and leaving your state, which they did. I mean, officers after 2020 said, we're out of here, and went to all these other departments across the country because they weren't supported and they weren't allowed to do their job. That's real. That's a fact, right? That's not, you know, that's not supposition. So at the end of the day, he's got a very hard record to try to defend. And again, I go back to that 8% of swing voters. That's what we're really focusing on. Those folks want results. They just want to know their lives are going to change for the better. And when they go into that ballot box on November 5th, and you vote for change, you're voting for your anxieties, right? I can't pay my rent. The electricity bills are too high. I just want my kids to be safe in my community. It's those anxieties as an individual that challenge you and force you to say, we're doing something different. I'm going to make sure my vote counts and doesn't just do the same old thing. I'm going to make sure my vote stands for something different and kind of brings that disruption that we all know Washington needs. I mean, to say Washington, the status quo of Washington is okay – right there and then, nobody agrees with that, right? So, you know, I think former President Trump has to tap into that gut reaction, that gut connection that he really captured in 2016, lost it a little in 2020 for a variety of reasons. He can recapture that gut connection of, hey, I know what you guys are going through, and I'm going to disrupt this system because it's not doing right by you as an individual.
Governor Chris Sununu, you always do right by us. Thanks so much. Have a great
weekend. Thank you, brother. Be good, everybody.
All right, we're all going to be watching the debate. Back to wrap up this hour in just a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen is the most recommended memory support brand by pharmacists.
Yep, Prevagen, never been more popular than it is right now, man. As a country, we're forgetting everything, so it's time to remember that, especially when you come up on our 250th birthday. Let's start talking about 71% of young Democrats say they would not go on a date with someone who voted for Donald Trump. That's in a brand new poll by Generation Lab. That does not surprise me. The poll also showed that 31% of college GOP members said they wouldn't date someone who voted for President Biden. How much lower is Republican standards? We're much more, I guess many think Republicans are much more tolerant.
But I think you're already, by saying like 71% of young Democrats, already polling, like they're asking your political affiliation first. It's how they're identifying themselves. But maybe Republicans are more tolerant. I also think probably the average young person, hopefully, isn't talking about politics first and foremost.
Next, football is back. Ravens against the Chiefs, a rematch of the conference final. Ravens lost that one. They lost this one by a toe. Listen.
And first four, Lamar trying to make magic happen. Throw an end zone. Wait, wait, 2 feet down. Yes, touchdown. What a play.
Runner's toe, hit out of bounds. It's an incomplete pass. The game is over. Kansas City has won.
27-20. It literally is his toe. The great play. A great play by Lamar Jackson. Unable to complete the final pass. They lose 27-20. The Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson fell to 1-5 against Patrick Mahomes. The other big story, Taylor Swift and Brittany Mahomes were in separate boxes cheering for their team. The question is, Allison, was it because Brittany Mahomes made it clear she's voting for Trump?
I say no. She liked one of his posts. They didn't sit together every single game. And didn't they say Taylor was going to buy a box for this season? I can't find if she did or not. But
well, put it this way. They're probably a huge waiting list. She's got to get in line like everybody else.
It's Taylor Swift. I don't think so.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. Congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.